Welcome to the ASAM InfoBoard podcast, episode 2, understanding the AMR, antimicrobial resistance threat, and why it matters for Asia and Europe. Increasingly around the world, the medicines we rely on to treat and prevent infections are losing their power. Scientists call this phenomenon antimicrobial resistance, or AMR. It's one of the most urgent threats to global health and the focus of today's conversation. I'm Jason Gale, a health editor with Bloomberg News in Melbourne. Joining me are three leading experts who bring global, regional, and political perspectives on the issue. Dr. Ketevan Kandalaki, Technical Officer for Antimicrobial Resistance, Governance, and Stewardship with the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Europe, based in Copenhagen. Professor Xu Li Yang, Director of the Asia Center for Health Security at the National University of Singapore's Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health. And in Lisbon, Dr. Guillaume Duarte, Executive Director of UNITE, a global network of parliamentarians working to strengthen health systems through better, more sustainable policies. Ketevan, let's begin with you. When people hear that medicines designed to kill germs aren't working, they often think of antibiotic resistance, but antimicrobial resistance is broader than that. Can you explain what AMR encompasses?
So when we talk about antimicrobial resistance, this refers to the ability of the various microbes, including bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites, to resist the effects of the medications that are designed to kill them or to stop their growth. So indeed, antimicrobial resistance is a broader term than antibiotic resistance, but antibiotic resistance is also part of the antimicrobial resistance. And it's a subset of AMR, specifically referring to the bacteria becoming resistant to antibiotics. But globally, we are also facing the issues of antiviral resistance. This is when viruses can develop resistance to antiviral drugs, making the treatment for viral infections like HIV, influenza, hepatitis less effective. We are also facing antifungal resistance. This is when fungus can become resistant to antifungal medications, complicating the treatment of infections like Candida. And antiparasitic resistance is when parasites such as malaria can develop resistance to antiparasitic drugs. It makes various impacts also on various sectors, and this goes beyond the human health and includes also veterinary medicine and agriculture.
Right. And what's driving this process? Why is it accelerating now?
The rapid escalation of antimicrobial resistance is predominantly driven by the inappropriate and excessive use of antimicrobial agents. A key contributor is the overprescription of antibiotics, particularly for viral infections such as influenza and common cold, for which those medications are ineffective. Additionally, the widespread use of antibiotics in agriculture and animal husbandry significantly exacerbates the problem. The unsupervised use of antibiotics, often without medical consultation or prescription, further compounds the issue, especially when medications are taken at incorrect dosages for inappropriate indications and when treatment courses are not completed. The availability of antibiotics over the counter, despite their classification as prescription-only medicines, remains a critical concern. Addressing those challenges necessitates a coordinated global response, encompassing enhanced stewardship of existing antimicrobials, investment in the development of new therapeutic options, and the implementation of robust infection prevention and control measures.
Got it. Li Yang, antimicrobials aren't just used in human medicine, as we just heard. They're widely used in agriculture and food production too. Can you explain how their use in farming contributes to AMR?
Thank you, Jason. I think Dr. Kandalaki has put it across very well earlier. And I think the best way to think about it is in evolutionary terms. So if we think of antimicrobial agents as a kind of selection pressure, then the more we use of it, whether appropriately or inappropriately, the more likely it is to trigger a response in the microbes who will want to adapt and survive the amounts of antimicrobials in the environment, in animals, and in us. So by feeding antimicrobials to animals, using it in farming, we drive a process by which the bacteria in the environment and in these animals become more resistant to the antimicrobials.
And I'm wondering if you can explain a little bit more about why this isn't just a problem for animals, but a serious risk for human health as well.
Two things can happen. The first is that the bacteria in animals, when they become resistant to antibiotics, sometimes they can jump across to infect humans. This is, I guess, analogous to the process where viruses jump species to humans as well, as we recently observed during the COVID-19 pandemic, which is also true for all kinds of different other viral outbreaks that the world has experienced. So the bacteria can cross over from animals to humans, and perhaps the most well-known case is that of methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, a type of drug-resistant bacteria that jumped across from pigs, originally first discovered in the Netherlands to humans, and which has then caused multiple hundreds of human infections around the world. It's not just the bacteria that can leap across, but also the resistance genes that they have within them, because these genes are not confined generally to one type of bacteria, but sometimes they can be transferred across to other species of bacteria as well. So in that case, antimicrobial resistance genes from an animal bacteria can be transferred across to a human bacteria, which then can cause infections in humans and be more difficult to treat.
Right, so it's not just the bacteria, but the genes that they carry that we have to worry about. But just to underscore how serious this is, a Lancet study published in September 2024 estimated more than 39 million deaths from antibiotic-resistant infections between now and 2050. Liang, when people hear those numbers, it's easy to think this is someone else's problem or a problem for the future. Can you explain, you know, is this really the case? In a place like Singapore, for example, it's not a major food-producing country. Would you expect lower levels of AMR, or is that a misconception?
I think this is the problem of big numbers and us being humans, right? Big numbers just sound so abstract. Millions don't matter more than a single case that we know. But in Singapore, we definitely have the problem of antimicrobial resistance, and there are probably over 1,000 deaths every year that can be attributed to drug-resistant infections in humans. But across the border to other low-middle-income countries in the region, my colleagues have conducted research that showed that a high proportion of patients with these drug-resistant infections die because they are either given the wrong treatments or they are not given the right treatments in time.
What are some of the ways AMR is already impacting human health across Asia?
I think this has shaped how hospital treatments of patients with infections has been done. In hospitals in Singapore, in Thailand, in India, for instance, when a patient develops a fever in a hospital, we assume straight away that we could be dealing with the drug-resistant infections, and we start by giving very broad-spectrum antibiotics, that is, antimicrobials that target a whole bunch of different bacteria. And you can see that there's a potential there. As we use more and more of these antibiotics, we have the risks of creating more and more resistant bacteria as well. In some countries, certain surgical procedures that are life-saving become a real risk, because when patients become infected with drug-resistant infections after such surgery, then treatment becomes very prolonged and they don't recover as well as they would if they had never experienced an infection with such bacteria. So definitely you can see that in Asia, both in low, middle and high income countries like Singapore, the presence of AMR has shaped our healthcare and has affected a lot of patients who otherwise would have had better outcomes to their illnesses.
To what extent does having sort of easier access to antibiotics in many parts of the region, you know, often without a prescription?
In Singapore, which is very small, an island, we're quite lucky. You can only get antibiotics with a prescription, and you can't walk into a pharmacy and just get antibiotics across the counter. But in Singapore, you can find a doctor very easily as well. They're all over the island. In bigger countries, especially those with rural communities, it is very hard to find a doctor, and sometimes people have to travel many hours just to see one. In that case, it's impossible to have a law that says that antibiotics should only be given if there's a prescription. Hence, these patients should have access to antibiotics, but that creates a problem of antibiotic misuse and inappropriate antibiotic use.
Yeah, Yatavan, let's come back to you. What about in Europe? How is AMR affecting modern medicine, things like surgery?
Indeed, in WHO European region alone, AMR is directly responsible for over 133,000 deaths each year, and it's directly linked to over 500,000 deaths. And there's also a huge economic impact costing the European Union and the European Economic Area over 11 billion euros annually due to increased healthcare expenses and productivity loss. We also see there are geographic variations. There's noticeable north to south, west to east gradient in resistance rates, and the higher rates observed in the southern and eastern European part of the region compared to the northern and western Europe. With regards to the links of AMR to the other healthcare aspects, AMR indeed exacerbates the burden of non-communicable diseases by complicating the treatment, increasing mortality rates, and infections in patients with chronic diseases, like you mentioned, cancer or diabetes, become harder and more difficult to treat due to resistant pathogens. This, of course, leads to prolonged illness, higher healthcare costs, treatment failures. We also see that climate change has significant impact to the spread of infectious diseases, and this is leading to a higher demand for antibiotics and contributing to the development of AMR. We also know that aging population is expected to be doubled by 2050 in the region, and AMR also poses significant threat to vulnerable populations. Elderly individuals often have weakened immune system, and they require more frequent visit to healthcare centers, and the risk of acquiring healthcare-associated infections are more risky for those group of people, and as they are more susceptible to infections that could be harder to treat.
Right. Given your role at WHO, you're also monitoring the global landscape. Are there wider trends or risks beyond Europe that you find especially concerning?
Of course, globally speaking, we know that antimicrobial resistance has no recognition of borders. So migrations, people moving, as I mentioned, agricultural practices, trade, travels, all this contribute to the sharing of the resistance genes. And countries that have really good stewardship practices will also be exposed to the resistant infections through the globalization and the exchange of travels, foods, etc. So this is another reason why the WHO has established the GLASS, which is a global surveillance of antimicrobial resistance that helps to monitor the trends across the globe from all countries, and helps to identify the needs and actions to address those upcoming threats on a timely basis.
This crisis has been building for decades, and it's not just a matter of science. It's about politics and policy too. Guillaume, putting your policy hat on, to what extent are our political leaders truly aware of the AMR threat? How motivated are they to act?
I would like to also take the opportunity to thank you for thinking of us, the United Parliamentarians, to participate in this talk, because it's not usually a common group to be invited. And it's quite relevant due to the responsibilities in not only legislation, but budget setting, and as well government accountability. But going back to your question, I think that political, I would say that awareness is growing, but motivation still varies. And the drawing out on recent experience with parliamentary national strategy and multilateral work through WHO and others, I would say that this is definitely growing, and it's getting the motivation that it is. So I would say that many political leaders' efforts to Weimar, especially in context of post-COVID preparedness and global health security, but still understand still its systemic implications, how it threatens everything from routine care to very specific and specialized care. And you can see this then in the lack of proper legislation or the specific or the technically aware legislation based on evidence that sometimes it's harder to legislate because it goes against the common and the implemented status. So of course we understand that as motivation tends to spike after crisis or international events, for example, G7, G20, even the UNGA high-level declarations, we also recognize that this wanes quickly without political pressure or public demands.
What kinds of policies have already been introduced to reduce antimicrobial misuse, and are any proving particularly effective?
I would say that there's a lot of policies, a lot of actions out there. Maybe we need to systemize them more. So I would say that most countries now have a national action plan. It's aligned with WHO Global Action Plan. It covers issues already mentioned here, like antimicrobial stewardship in hospitals, guidelines, prescription audits, regulations on veterinary agricultural use, for example, banning certain antibiotics for animal feed. Specific policies or actions to improve surveillance systems, public awareness campaigns, and initiatives for research and development of new antibiotics, vaccines, and diagnostics, for example, GRDP. But I would say that they all need a bit more accountability. They need a bit more impact, and they definitely need to be taken a bit more seriously by the legislators, both from resource allocation, but also from the accountability perspective. In parliamentary settings, we're starting to see national legislation limiting over-the-counter antibiotic sales, budget allocations for especially for lab capacity and data sharing, which is also very important. And inclusion of IMR in broader health system reforms. For example, and just to mention that, I think IMR was a present issue and quite rightly so during the negotiations of the pandemic treaty and with the notion of One Health as well.
Right. And what are some of the key lessons from countries that are getting this right?
I would say that, first of all, and apologize for pushing for this head, but start making IMR political. I would say that it's important to frame it as a development and economic issue, not just an health threat, because this is usually what gets the attention of other areas in the government, the ones that allocate resources and actually can support moving the society into the right direction. Then empower legislators, and I think that all of us here contribute to that directly or indirectly. But just to recall that, legislators in almost every country, they can push for budget lines, hold ministry accountable, and bridge human, animal, and environmental health. And this last issue is quite important, as usually these areas, they still work in a very siloed way. Everyone likes to have their own hat or individual work. And indeed, for some issues, I think all of us should be already thinking about One Health and not only a human or animal or even environmental health. And then I would say that we still need to invest in people. This podcast is an example of it. We need really to bring awareness out there. And then lastly, but not least important, in fact, one of the most important things, I think the regulation still needs to be strengthened and enforced.
As we've heard, AMR isn't just a problem for lower income countries or isolated regions. It's a global challenge and it's evolving quickly. Ketevan, is there a coordinated global effort underway to fight AMR? And what is the WHO doing to support countries right now?
Indeed, in 2015, WHO at the World Health Assembly adopted the Global Action Plan to address antimicrobial resistance and the aspect that Guilherme was also mentioning, like improving awareness, strengthening knowledge and evidence for through surveillance and research, looking into effective infection prevention control measures and optimizing the use of antimicrobials in human and animal health have been identified as the key objectives for the Global Action Plan. Additionally, what was also identified important was engagement and investment in research and development of new antibiotics, because one of the challenges and issues that we are facing with the MR is lack of new antibiotics coming on the market. And another aspect that Guillermo also touched upon was behavior and accountability. These are also aspects that makes us responsible, all of us, regardless of what hat we are carrying, whether we are stakeholders, policymakers, healthcare providers, or general public, because our behavior is what drives the development and spread of resistance. Globally speaking, WHO will be also reviewing the Global Action Plan because this has been adopted almost 10 years ago. However, many countries still struggle in translating the policies into actions. We are now developing antimicrobial resistance accountability index. So this index will ensure meaningful impact, will safeguard the health and economies while tackling one of the greatest challenges of our time, and will provide also transparency in efforts to address AMR and track the progress of the countries in implementing the AMR strategies.
Guillaume, like climate change, AMR knows no borders. Where do you see the biggest opportunities for Asia-Europe collaboration?
Absolutely. AMR, like climate change, is definitely a transboundary threat that demands shared responsibility and coordinated action. I believe that Asia and Europe are uniquely positioned to lead this charge, each bringing strengths that are benefit from. And they can also give the example of being able to talk. I mean, nowadays, there's a shortage overall of multilateralism. And I think that the fact that we can all agree in a way forward, that would be already a very good example of how to collaborate. But I will leave three main ideas. The first, jointly surveillance and data sharing. Then on the second thing, I think One Health innovation. We've also heard today why it matters. And as I understand, Asia has pioneered One Health models in countries like Thailand and Vietnam, while Europe offers a strong regulatory strength and research and development funding. So perhaps there could be an opportunity to set up some pilot projects between the regions focused on specific things like alternative to antibiotics, namely the poultry reforms, vaccines, phage therapy, of course co-financed and led by technicians from both regions. And in the end, again with the policy, but I would say policy harmonization. Of course, we have to understand what works exactly, respecting cultural differences and expectations, because we also understand that policy is a very local thing. But the EU has strong antibiotic use restrictions in agriculture, and this could lead to launch, for example, a policy forum on AMR, where both regions could participate and where parliamentarians and regulators would align standards for human, animal, and also environmental health. And also, not less important, strengthening global alliances.
Liang, from your vantage point, where do you see the most potential for cross-regional cooperation between Asia and Europe in tackling AMR?
I feel I'm just going to repeat things that Guillaume has already touched on. But from my perspective, I think there are three areas. Firstly, regulation of antimicrobial use in agriculture, research innovation and partnerships, and then finally, capacity developments in infection prevention and antimicrobial stewardship. Europe is ahead of Asia, and in fact, the rest of the world when it comes to stringent regulations for antimicrobial use in farm animals. For instance, I believe the European Union already banned the use of antibiotics as growth promoters as far back as 2006. In Asia, this is a really touchy issue with strong pushback from the agricultural industry. But I think if the European agricultural industry and regulators are able to share their techniques and experiences and success stories, in raising animals without antibiotic growth promoters, there could be a way forward on this matter in the future. It'll take many years, but I think it's important to start, and this to me is key. Secondly, there can definitely be more research and innovation investments in antimicrobial resistance, including developments of new antimicrobials, diagnostics, and more collaborative research in general. Europe has much more international funding for research that can benefit and uplift the low and middle income countries in the region, and Singapore, I think, should play a part in this as well. Finally, antimicrobial stewardship programs vary widely across Asia, and European hospitals have more experience and institutionalized approaches. In fact, Singapore, many years ago, we went to learn from the Scandinavian countries how they kept their infection rates and drug-resistant infection rates low. So I think there can be opportunities for sharing and capacity developments that will benefit not just the Asian hospitals, but also European clinicians and scientists.
Before we wrap up, maybe a quick final thought from each of you, one short takeaway or a personal reminder you'd like listeners to leave with.
Antimicrobial resistance, AMR, is not a challenge of the future. It is a pressing and serious threat of today. Effectively addressing AMR demands coordinated, cross-sectoral action encompassing human health, animal health, agriculture, and the environment. It is imperative that the commitments made at the national and the global levels are swiftly translated into a concrete, urgent actions. A key message to remember is this. Every time we use antibiotics, we give bacteria an opportunity to become stronger. Therefore, antibiotics must be used wisely, only when truly necessary, and strictly as prescribed. And efforts against antimicrobial resistance begins with each of us, through informed choices and responsible use.
I would say, not being too a scaremonger or fearmonger, but I would say that we should look at this IMR issue as something that can really threaten our current health system. And if we're comfortable understanding and with the notion that if we've got a small infection, we go to the hospital or we go to our assistant doctor and get it treated. And this we can only do by respecting the process and by understanding that sometimes we should get treated with antibiotics and sometimes we don't. And we need to have patience if the professionals or technicians tell us that, okay, this time we cannot use antibiotics.
Well, I think antimicrobial resistance and its syllable term can seem very abstract and far away. And not likely to affect the average person. But nonetheless, I think it's important to be aware of it. And there are things that the individual can do as well, which can help in our own little way to reduce or mitigate the impact of this problem. And that would include, for instance, observing hand hygiene, making sure that we are updated on our vaccines.
Yes, clearly we can all play a role in tackling this problem. I'd like to thank our panelists for their insights. We've heard how antimicrobial resistance threatens lives, healthcare systems, and economies, and how it requires coordinated global action. If you'd like to learn more, the WHO website offers excellent resources and toolkits on AMR, and the Asia Europe Foundation welcomes your feedback. Visit their website or connect with them on social media to keep the conversation going.
This podcast was produced by the ASIF Communications Department. Stay tuned for the next episode in October.